Imagine the scene. It wouldn't take much imagining, in fact. 27 families of non-English speakers arriving to a quiet Irish town, sparking scenes of denunciation, political protest and anti-migrant sentiment. It might be an easy thing to imagine, but you're going to have to dispel the imagination you might have, because it's not asylum seekers we're talking about. In fact, it's not even immigrants. The incident we're talking about was back in 1935, when 27 families from the west of Ireland moved to a newly formed Gaeltacht in Rathcarn in County Meath. It was an interesting and controversial social experiment, moving Connacht Irish speakers into the Leinster region. It was a fascinating link, if you like, between the land and language questions. But it didn't quite go smoothly. And Donal Fallon is here in studio, as he always is the time of Sunday, to tell us all about it. Good afternoon, Donal.
Good to be here.
The Gaeltacht we're talking about, just in case people have forgotten, it does still exist.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a chance people might be listening from there today. Rathcarn in 2006 had a population of less than 450 people. It's part of it's a very small Gaeltacht area in Meath. It's a small, warm and welcoming village and still a functioning Gaeltacht. And its foundation, you know, is a story that's fascinating, because it's wrapped up in what I consider the most transformative decade of modern Irish history, post-independence, the 1930s. You know, and slogans like "This land is not for Connemara people" and "No more migrants wanted here" began appearing on the walls in this quiet town in Meath, while shots were fired at houses in the district. So it's a remarkable kind of story, a forgotten story, a deliberately forgotten story, I would suggest, from post-independence Ireland.
Yeah, we'll come back to the idea of shots being fired. Hello, by the way, if there are any listeners in Rathcarn and Volugib, this was an idea of its time, spearheaded by no less than Eamon De Valera himself.
Yeah, it's very much in keeping with the ideology of the government of the day. You know, the De Valera-led Fianna Fáil of the 1930s. They came into power in 1932, 10 years after the Civil War. And, you know, it's funny because it's the idea of the papers call it a colony, a Gaeltacht colony.
Yeah, colony is a very
such a loaded word. But isn't it like such a great reversal of the Cromwellian conquest, the real, you know, colonial times, to hell or to Connacht? So these people from Connacht were now, you know, coming back into civilization as they saw it in the state. And land was the great concern to the De Valera government. You know, in Dublin and other urban centres, they built suburbs on a massive scale. Still the most remarkable housing drive Ireland has ever seen. Cabra, Kimmage, Crumlin, you name it. Mm. Waging war on the tenement. And also, I would say, doing a favour for the developers. That may have been a factor in all of that as well. So suburbanisation in Dublin is driven by economic and cultural concerns. And I think at the same time, there's economic and cultural factors involved in this idea of trying to take a Gaeltacht and put it into Leinster.
Yeah, and the idea of trying to cultivate a Gaeltacht where none had previously existed in Leinster was partly fostered by the idea that in the 1930s, even the premise of the Gaeltacht elsewhere in Ireland, they were in deep trouble.
Well, look, everyone's broke in the 1930s. I mean, they're broke on Wall Street in New York City, and they're definitely broke in the Gaeltacht. And you've got this stark, you know, moment of crisis. There's agitation, there's protest. What's happening in the 1930s is that there's enormous levels of emigration, of course. People are leaving, but people are coming back because the global economy has tanked. This is the Great Depression. So we're broke. And the first government of the state, a little earlier than this in the 1920s, they tried to get down to the business of just trying to map out what is the Gaeltacht, where do people speak Irish, with kind of unsurprising results that showed there were strong pockets of the language in the west and the south, but a very worrying picture of decline elsewhere. But it is worth saying, you know, in the 1930s, a lot of what we're talking about today, and even the concern around these people moving into Meath, is an economic question. And the economic question in the 1930s is a lot bigger than just Ireland. I mean, the Great Depression has hit and is in full effect.
Yeah, and as you say, if Wall Street is broke, the Gaeltacht's not going to be much better off at the time. Within the Gaeltacht, and we're not just talking about the Rathcarn one, but within Gaeltacht in general, there was the beginning of a lot of activism as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. A group called Muinteanna Gaeltacht emerges, the tireless activist and academic Marcian O'Kyan in its ranks, an incredible figure. He lectures in Trinity College Dublin, which is a very bold thing to do, you know, if you're a Catholic. Yeah. It's very frowned upon at that time. But it's a very strong kind of lobbying group that's campaigning for the Gaeltacht in the 30s and the 40s. And they pull some great stunts on Turris and Air, the Journey East, 1934. They say, look, they're not listening to us in Dublin. So they quite literally get on their bikes and they descend on Dublin, you know, hundreds of men from the Gaeltacht, the Journey East, bring the issue to the door, the government, the media, and all of that. And O'Kyan's this amazing man. I mean, he later ends up sitting in the Curragh internment camp with Brendan Behan during World War II. He actually enlisted a young Brendan Behan into the army, which landed them both in the Curragh.
Wow.
But the 30s are more innocent times than the 40s, you know, and O'Kyan is one of the people who's he's a recognised public face of the Gaeltacht and the Gaeltacht people. De Valera, I would say, is no social radical like Marcian O'Kyan, but they have one thing in common. You know, De Valera believes that the Irish language is at the centre of our identity. And as far as he's concerned, it's one of the things that makes us unique. You know, he describes it brilliantly as a thing of the mind, which marks us out out as a distinct nation. It's more than just the symbol. It's an essential part of our nationhood. So with this ideology, this devilarian idea of Ireland, which is always reduced to this laughing, you know, the comely maidens at the crossroads and all of that. But Dev has an idea of an Irish Ireland. And when you couple that with the land question, it's easy to see why De Valera and other people found something quite romantic in this idea of moving the Irish language from the West into the East.
Yeah, this is a total tangent, actually, in the topic of Eamon De Valera's nation building. But I saw some footage. Obviously, Leinster House has just been finished in a giant redevelopment. And there's a lot of stuff in Leinster House at the moment about the redevelopment that Dev had proposed of Merrion Square. And he wanted to have a concert venue there. And he wanted to flatten a lot of the Georgian buildings and to build a brand new government buildings and a new cathedral, which was going to be on the square or nearby to it. Interestingly, he was leaving Holles Street Hospital exactly where it was, but he wanted to have this kind of government quarter because he wanted to create this sort of Whitehall where previously none had existed, because he wanted to create this permanent home of a permanent Irish government. But that's a tangent anyway. The reason why all these Gaeltacht families were so annoyed, or rather the removal of these Gaeltacht families was so inflammatory to some people. What was getting people so annoyed? What were the Gaeltacht families actually being given to move?
The plan was families would get a house, land, farm animals and farming implements in exchange for their land in the West. So the line of some people was, well, these people are giving up bad land and they're getting good land instead. And, you know, from the get-go, there were kind of voices of opposition. Sometimes there were quite surprising voices of opposition. Actually, some people in the West of Ireland feared the impact it would have on the Gaeltacht there.
Well, it'd be a bit of a brain drain, I suppose.
Exactly, exactly. And their line was, well, look, improve our standing in this place rather than making us move.
Yeah.
So yeah, the impact of the Gaeltacht in the West was a real concern. The exodus of these people would mostly have been, they feared, young men, young families. But I think the primary concern, and it's not an entirely unfair concern, comes from some people in Meath, poorer farmers in particular, who are asking, you know, where's this kind of land and economic support? Mm. It's never been offered to us.
Let's go back to the language of colony or colonists. Like you said, it's a very loaded language.
It is,
it was actually, this wasn't just at the fringes of the debate. Central to this whole question mark about moving people was this idea of calling it a colony.
This is a long-running debate in the Dáil, and the language in the Dáil is incredible. Patrick Belton, who's a really curious figure, he's later involved in the Irish Christian Front and the kind of emerging kind of far right in Ireland in the 1930s. He's a property developer, and you know, he's primarily, I think property primarily motivates his opposition to what he views as kind of free housing for the undeserving. Now, he eventually lost the seat in 1937, by which point he was kind of going on mad outbursts in the Dáil about Jews and everything else. But in the 1930s, in 1935, this is his big issue. You know, it's these free houses as he sees them in the Gaeltacht. And what Belton, the language he uses, is absolutely extraordinary. He accuses the government of, quote, simply trying to find homes for imbeciles on the land. And he plays on all these old stereotypes. You know, you build this new Gaeltacht, he says, the inhabitants won't engage with the community and they're going to spend their time making poutine all day.
This is Punch magazine.
Magazine. It is, exactly. It brings to mind those kind of 19th century cartoons of Irish drunk Fenians sitting on, you know, dynamite sticks. And the language in the press, you know, they call it a colony, the colonists. It's a very curious choice of words when it's applied to people, descendants of those who've been moved into Connacht, as we said earlier on. But it wasn't always used in a bad way. You know, even people that were kind of in favour of the resettlement called the people colonists. The Meath Chronicle said, the greatest feature of the colonisation scheme is the bringing back of the living Irish tongue to an area where it's virtually unknown. But in retrospect, it's difficult now, looking back, not to feel that that kind of emotive language, colony, is unhelpful. Mm. Then you get basically tourists, I would call them language tourists, arriving in Rathcarn to have a look. And the Meath Chronicle says, on Sunday afternoon, the place is crowded with trippers, and some were thoughtless enough to go looking in the windows. So it's like these poor people from Connemara were a spectacle, you know, like going to Dublin Zoo to gaze upon them in County Meath.
Well, again, and the use of language like colony or colonists, that it does portray them as being some sort of other, that they're not just fellow Irish citizens who've just come from a different county who happen to speak a different language, that they are sort of being pigeonholed in that way. But the tensions then locally were so strong that it even led to a visit from the Taoiseach trying to calm things down.
It got very ugly. I mean, you had the intimidation of kind of land commission workers, the families themselves, but also like the painting of slogans, as we touched on at the beginning, no more migrants, that kind of stuff appearing on the walls is quite ugly. And it gets bad enough that in 1938 the Taoiseach and others kind of arrive for a rally in Meath, which is designed to quell any kind of outstanding tensions. And the way it's reported on in the press is incredible. They say, you know, through the medium of that which both love, the Irish language, the migrant found that the Meath man was not out for his blood, and the native discovered that the colonist was a human being like himself, not a human humourless, suspicious individual, but a cheerful, friendly fellow, anxious to live amicably with his neighbours. I mean, it's like these people have been dropped from the sky, as you say. But it's remarkable. It takes De Valera himself going down and trying to sell this to the people of Meath as part of the great Irish-Ireland project.
But the fact that he was able to quench some of these protests must have been a significant achievement in and of itself, because we have some of the first-hand accounts from those tensions that still survive, and they're pretty grim.
Yeah, the writer Eimear Martin wrote a lovely piece in the Irish Independent last year about this, and she grew up in the area, and she talked about, you know, her father's memories of when these people arrived. But I think what's interesting reading his account is that, you know, he makes the point that ultimately the scheme and the response to it, it might have served to drive some of the new arrivals away from the Irish language. So if you arrived in this town in Meath, you're like, well, no one likes us here because we don't speak English. One response to that might be that just start speaking English. And he remembered that, I remember the Irish speakers trying to come into the local pub for a drink and being run out of the place as soon as they spoke. Sadly, instead of embracing them for what they could teach us, they were looked down on. My mother was a school teacher in the small national school. Some of these new settlers wanted to put their children into that school to learn English rather than keep them stigmatised in their brand new Gaeltacht. So that may have been one effect of the tension around these people, that it drove them perhaps from Irish.
As we mentioned, the Rathcarn Volleygabe Gaeltacht, it survives to this day, but the picture then nationwide in terms of Gaeltachtaí and whether they're flourishing is somewhat mixed, let's fair to say.
Yeah, and I mean, eventually when things settled down, there were other Irish settlements around Rathcarn. I think Rathcarn worked because those people came from one area in the West, so you'd one dialect and quick integration, and the families kind of knew each other. Later schemes in Meath didn't always go as smoothly. The Irish language today, is the picture healthy or unhealthy? It depends on who you ask and how they spin the figures. But at the time of the 2006 census, the population of the Gaeltacht areas nationwide is only 91,862 people. That's 2.1% of the population of the Irish state. Now, there are Irish-speaking districts north of the border too. There's a lot going on, in particular in urban areas of Belfast. But what is obvious is that the Gaeltachts are remarkably small communities, and some of them are shrinking. Aonrian and Waterford are Ring. That is a population of less than 2,000 people, the majority, but not all of whom are Irish speakers. The Meath Gaeltacht is similar in size and composition. But on the other side, friends of mine, school teachers who teach Irish, will say, look at the rapid rise of the Gaelscoil in Dublin and other cities. That's part of the story of the language as well. So maybe the idea of the Gaeltacht, the designated place where Irish is spoken, maybe that's passed. You know, the rural-urban divide on the language question may have passed. But Rathcarn is still there.
Still there, still going strong. And still home to many's a young hormonal teenager every summer going along for their Cúpla Seachtaine and in a cursus hour as well. Donal, as ever, thank you very much. Donal Fallon is an author and historian. He's the creator of the Cymru to Be blog and books, volumes 1 and 2 of which are in all good bookshops now. That